Now for tonight's guest. Nadine Strausen is currently a professor of law at NYU Law School. She's been held that position since 1989. She's been president of the ACLU since February of 1991 and has been and was general counsel since 1986. Before that time, Professor Strausen clerked for the Minnesota Supreme Court, has worked at Sullivan Cromwell, worked in a law firm in Minneapolis. She's received many awards. A few of them are listed in the brochure I'd like to highlight. She was one of the first women to receive the USJC's 10 Outstanding Young American Awards in 1986. Later that year, she became the first American woman to win the JC's International Outstanding Young Persons Award. And the National Law Journal chose her as one of the 100 most influential lawyers in America. She is a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Law School and worked on the Harvard Law Review, although apparently reluctantly, or somewhat reluctantly. And her specialties, or her particular interests, as I could see, are First Amendment issues and reproductive issues, especially nowadays, with it, both of them being under direct, I guess, attack would be her phrase, in front of the Supreme Court. So I'd like to welcome Professor Nadine Strausen back to Harvard Law School.
Thank you very much, Michael. Every time I speak to a law school audience, I can't believe it. You always sit in the back. And I promise I'm not going to call on you, even though I am a law school professor. Thank you very much. Somebody's daring to move into the third row as opposed to the fourth row. I really have not been in this classroom since I took constitutional law here myself, so it's a nice sentimental return journey. And I do have at least one very fond memory of this particular classroom. I do remember sitting in here when somebody ran in excitedly with the news in January of 1973, when I was a first-year student, that the Supreme Court had handed down Roe v. Wade. And I remember there was great cheering and excitement. Little did we realize that before Roe would reach its 20th anniversary, that it would, in fact, be under assault. And I have to say, my own view is that it has effectively been overturned already, and it's just a matter of time before the Supreme Court honestly tells us that that is, in fact, the case. It's already done so rather evasively and deceptively. Well, that's getting ahead of the point, because I will be focusing on current threats to the to civil liberties, as I was asked to. It wasn't until I got here and saw the posters that I saw that I was that the topic that had been assigned to me did specifically focus on the Supreme Court. And I want you to know, even if I had not known that, I was planning on talking about the Supreme Court, because it is the single greatest threat to civil liberties that we face these days. Mark Twain said something about Congress that I think is now true of the court. He said, "No one is safe while they're in session." And often during the past year, as I've been heading up the ACLU, I am asked by reporters and others, what is the most important civil liberties issue that you face? And I have to give the answer that I cannot say there is one or even a series of substantive issues that stands out. The reason is that the most important, the most pervasive issue by far is the institutional one, the increasing hostility of the federal courts headed up by the United States Supreme Court, and the increasing abandonment of the federal court's traditional role as the ultimate guarantor of rights for individuals and minority groups. That is a pervasive problem that profoundly affects every single issue with which we deal. So I will concentrate on a few in my remarks, on a few particular issues, and Michael is absolutely right. I certainly consider free speech and reproductive freedom to be among the many important issues, but every point that I make, make no mistake about it, could equally well be made with respect to the entire spectrum of civil rights and civil liberties. You know, some people say, well, the Supreme Court is going to overturn Roe v. Wade, but it's an unenumerated right. There's no provision in the Constitution that expressly guarantees privacy. That is not the reason why reproductive freedom is in danger. Make no mistake about that. Certainly there is an express free speech guarantee in the First Amendment to the Constitution. As you've all learned, until recently, many scholars and justices had believed that free speech was even a preferred right, let alone just an express right, and it is equally under assault. So given the scarcity of time, I can't possibly begin to address the entire spectrum of civil rights and civil liberties. I just want you to be sure to understand that the examples I give will be representative of the points that could be made across the entire spectrum. And I would certainly welcome any questions about any particular rights or issues that I don't have time to talk about in my direct remarks. There was recently there have been several scathing analyses of what the Supreme Court has been doing in the popular press. I thought a piece by Linda Greenhouse, who is the New York Times legal reporter, made the point very well when she said, "This is a court with an appetite for revisiting first principles, for applying a kind of zero-based jurisprudence in which little that came before is accepted as a given." And I think that's right. Now putting on my constitutional law professor hat, I can tell you we are at a watershed era in constitutional history, one of those magic turning points, such as the famous one in 1937 when the court took the turn for the right, not in the political sense, but in the sense of the correct turn, in recognizing and finally living up to its potential as the ultimate bulwark against tyranny of the majority, when it announced that henceforward it would be particularly vigorous in enforcing rights of individuals and minority groups. It is precisely that earlier philosophy from which the court is now turning around. Before I continue with my analysis of the Supreme Court, I would like to say just a little bit about the American Civil Liberties Union, both so you can understand where I am coming from, as they say in California, see a little bit about what our agenda is and how it fits in with what the Supreme Court's role is, and also, again, so that to encourage you during the question and answer period to feel free to ask me anything about the ACLU's agenda. Woody Kaplan from the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts is nicely sitting in the back of the room behind membership material and information which he brought. He asked me to remind you that student dues for the ACLU are a mere $5. Let me tell you, we don't make any money on that. But there is, of course, an active chapter of the Civil Liberties Union here at Harvard Law School. But please take a look at some of the literature, because it's very interesting. Now, if I have to briefly capsule what it is that distinguishes the ACLU from the many other fine human rights organizations in this country, I think the easiest way I can do it is to say that we are the only one that seeks to defend the entire spectrum of civil liberties for all individuals and groups. There are many other organizations that focus, for example, on a particular set of rights: free speech rights, religious freedom, etc. There are other groups that define themselves by defending the rights of particular segments of the population: women, African Americans, and so forth. And I'm a member and supporter of many of those organizations, and I think they do wonderful work. However, I think it is essential that we also have in this country the ACLU, which alone seeks to neutrally and in a nonpartisan fashion defend the entire spectrum of rights and liberties for everyone. And the reason why I think that is so important is because of the indivisibility of rights. We have seen over and over again throughout history that if one right is violated for one individual or one group, then all rights of all individuals and groups are endangered. They really are inseparable. In fact, we recognize this recently when we announced that we were asking the Supreme Court to take the case that is now pending before it, which many people believe will be the vehicle for the court's reconsideration of Roe versus Wade. That is an ACLU case. At the time that we announced we were taking this case to the Supreme Court, we released a button which summarized this philosophy of the indivisibility of rights. In plain English, it said, take away one freedom and soon they're all gone. That was a statement that was made by one of the jurors in the Two Live Crew cases in Florida. You may remember a year and a half ago, the rap group Two Live Crew was prosecuted criminally for obscenity. And one of the jurors who voted in favor of acquittal walked out of the jury room and he said the reason why he voted for acquittal was, and it really was the ACLU's philosophy, I'm sure he didn't realize that, take away one freedom and soon they're all gone. We're probably best known for our work in the free speech area, but we do work across the entire spectrum, including many rights that are typically thought of as civil rights. We handle more voting rights cases than any other organization in the country. The same is true for school desegregation cases, rights of lesbians and gay men, women's rights, and reproductive freedom. For example, since Roe v. Wade was decided, the ACLU has handled 80% of all reproductive freedom cases all over the country. At this moment, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the case that is currently before the Supreme Court, is an ACLU case. It will be argued by an ACLU lawyer in April. In addition, there are half a dozen other what we call pipeline cases on abortion that are working their way up through the system, again, as potential vehicles for challenging or reaffirming Roe v. Wade, and those are also all ACLU cases. Let me just quickly tick off in alphabetical order the special projects that we have so you will have a sense of particular areas that we focus on in our work. They include projects on AIDS, aliens and immigration rights, art censorship, children's rights, death penalty, information and technology, the rights of lesbians and gay men, the National Security Project, National Prison Project, Project on Race and Poverty, the Reproductive Freedom Project, the Voting Rights Project, the Women's Rights Project, and finally, Project on Rights in the Workplace. With respect to the second aspect of the breadth of the ACLU agenda, the fact that we focus not only on all rights, but rights of all people, we do believe that it is essential to have an organization that takes a neutral posture, no matter whose ox is gored in terms of ideological agenda, and no matter whose ideological agenda is advanced. I think the best illustration of that posture now is with respect to ballot access. We do believe that all citizens in this country who are entitled to vote are entitled to have their choice of candidates for whom to vote. Therefore, we have been representing every presidential candidate across the entire political spectrum who has been denied ballot access. And you should not be surprised that it tends to be those candidates that are at either extreme of the political spectrum that are our clients. In Florida, for example, we are representing three who have been excluded from the Democratic ballot, including Lyndon LaRouche, a minister named Maloney, who was one of the founders of Operation Rescue, and then on the other end of the spectrum, David Duke. This gains us many friends and many enemies across the political spectrum. When an organization has a focus that is not ideological, we tend to have shifting alliances and coalitions. With this broad agenda, you can imagine we're very busy, and in fact, at any given moment, we have about 6,000 cases pending all over the country. We're very active in the Supreme Court, among others, and in fact, appear more often in the Supreme Court than any other entity other than the United States government itself. Often we're on the other side of the case from the United States government. Not always, but often. Last year, for the first time in the ACLU's 71-year history, we lost more cases than we won in the United States Supreme Court. And therefore, we've been trying to emphasize other techniques for approaching civil liberties. And mind you, we do not seek out Supreme Court review. Often we can't avoid it, though. And that leads me into my substantive focus for tonight, which is the Supreme Court. And I think it is telling that for the first time in the ACLU's long history, we have been on the losing end of more than 50% of all cases we're involved in. The Supreme Court's departure from past precedent, I think, is illustrated very well by the fact that last term, the court overturned a record number of its own precedents, all in the area of individual and minority group rights. It directly overturned 9 of its own precedents. And in the last decision of the term, or a decision issued on the last day of the term, Payne versus Tennessee, Chief Justice Rehnquist announced that henceforth the court would feel more free to overturn its past precedents. This led Thurgood Marshall to issue his last blistering dissent before announcing his resignation from the court. And he castigated the court for abandoning its role as the protector of the powerless. He then issued a list of what he called endangered precedents, landmark decisions protecting civil rights and civil liberties, which are under siege as a result of the Supreme Court's announced intention to more liberally overturn its own past decisions. Again, to put this in a nonpartisan perspective, let me hasten to quote also Justice Stevens, who until this court shifted so far to the right was considered a moderate, or even, if you can believe this, he used to be viewed as a conservative, but everything has shifted. It's odd to think of him as a liberal. He was appointed by a Republican president. He too was very disheartened with the court's abandonment of precedent, and he said that case marked a sad day for a great institution. In addition to directly overturning so many precedents in record numbers, the Supreme Court is also indirectly overturning past decisions. As I indicated, reproductive freedom is a very dramatic case in point. 2 years ago, in the Webster decision, the court said it was not interfering with Roe v. Wade, that Roe still is technically the law of the land, but I think Justice Blackmun had it right when he said, never in my memory has a plurality, it was a plurality decision, has a plurality gone about its business in such a deceptive fashion. At every level of its review, the plurality obscures the portent of its analysis. With feigned restraint, it announces that Roe is undisturbed. But this disclaimer is totally meaningless. The opinion is filled with winks and nods and knowing glances to those who would do away with Roe explicitly. Thus, not with a bang, but a whimper, the plurality discards a landmark case of the last generation. And since Webster, things have gotten worse. There have been several intervening Supreme Court decisions, culminating most recently in the so-called gag rule decision, Russ versus Sullivan, last summer, in which the Supreme Court, as you know, said that family planning clinics which receive federal money may not give information about abortion. Well, for the millions of poor women in this country who are completely dependent on those clinics, not only for all family planning, but indeed for all of their health services, to say that they still have a right to abortion, and by the way, under the Rust decision, even if abortion was medically indicated, it was still forbidden to give them information. What does it mean to say that Roe is still the law of the land for those women? As Blackmun said in his dissent in Rust, if a right is found to be unenforceable, even against flagrant attempts by government to circumvent it, then it ceases to be a right at all. Unfortunately, for many women in this country, including young women, including poor women, including women who live in rural areas, and for many women of color, Roe already is a dead letter. Now, I said earlier that We cannot say that the Supreme Court has been particularly hard on reproductive freedom because it's an unenumerated right. The Supreme Court has been equally hard even on traditionally preferred rights, and I will use free speech as an example. Until last term, one could say that even though the Rehnquist Court had chipped away at the edges of important free speech doctrines, at least there were a couple core principles of free speech jurisprudence that even this court, in its zeal to overturn civil liberties, even this court had respected those core principles. Yet last term, even those were subject to severe attack. The two principles that I'm talking about are, first, the principle of content neutrality, what the court had most recently reaffirmed in the two flag-burning decisions in 1989 and 1990. The court then said that it is a bedrock principle of free speech jurisprudence that government may not censor speech merely because the community disagrees with or is offended by the content or by the viewpoint expressed in that speech. The fact that this is a core principle, I think, is signaled by the composition of the majorities that joined in those two opinions. The majorities consisted not only of Brennan and Marshall on the left, but also of Kennedy and Scalia on the right. I think that indicates that we were indeed talking about a core, central, classical principle. The second classic principle that until recently seemed secure was a complementary one. Government may not censor speech because of disagreement with its content. The major justification for censoring speech, rather, was actual harm, actually caused by or imminently threatened by the speech, what many people think of as the clear and present danger test, and you all know that. Now, however, both of those principles were severely undermined by two decisions that the Supreme Court issued in the last term. First, the principle of content neutrality clearly was severely undermined by the gag rule decision. It's even worse than I had described earlier, because in addition to prohibiting the issuing of information about what is, at least technically, a constitutional right, the regulation that the court upheld went further and said that if a patient at one of these clinics asks for information about abortion, there is a script that the health professionals are required to recite. They must say, this clinic believes that abortion is not an appropriate method of family planning. Now, what more egregious situation of content-specific and viewpoint-discriminatory regulation can you have, other than the government literally putting words in the mouths of professionals, and yet the Supreme Court upheld it? Now, I said this decision has devastating consequences from the point of view of reproductive freedom, but even outside of and beyond that context, it's got sweepingly devastating consequences for free speech, because the rationale that the court used was so broad. Basically, it said, if you receive government money, the government may tie strings to the money, and the strings may include a waiver of constitutional rights, including the classic right to be free from viewpoint discrimination by the government in speech. And in a society where there are hardly any institutions that don't receive some form of government funding, to say that we may be forced to waive our constitutional rights as a condition of getting government funding is largely, in real terms, to suggest that constitutional rights will evaporate. In terms of the actual harm principle, that was dealt a severe blow in the court's decision in Barnes versus Glenn Theater, the so-called New Dancing decision. Again, as is true of the gag rule decision, the significance of the case from a free speech perspective far transcends the particular facts. The Supreme Court held that nude dancing is a form of protected expression. It did not create yet another category of speech that it says is outside the First Amendment, and in a very profound way, what it did was more damaging than if it had simply said, this is unprotected the way child pornography is, the way obscenity is, because what the court did now creates a loophole control for all speech that is prima facie subject to protection. Yes, the court said this is protected speech, but it may be prohibited. And what in that case, there was an absolute prohibition, not just a regulation, because of the community's sense of morality. The fact that the majority in the community is offended, morally offended, at the notion of some consenting adults going to watch other consenting adults disrobe themselves in this private area. And that, when you think about it, creates such an enormous gap to what had been the principle that community disagreement or offense with speech is never alone to justify repressing it. And we may see again the court stepping into that breach. Well, I'd like to put in historical perspective the court's abandonment of its traditional role as guarantor of civil rights and civil liberties. I think the traditional role, or the tradition, I have to say, in the last 50 years, as the court grew into, I think, the potential that was carved out for it in the Constitution, I think that role is best and most eloquently stated by language from an opinion called West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett. I hope you've heard it before. You should hear it many times. So let me just read you one passage. The court said, "The very purpose of a Bill of Rights was to withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitudes of political controversy, to place them beyond the reach of majorities and officials, and to establish them as legal principles to be applied by the courts. One's fundamental rights may not be submitted to a vote. They depend on the outcome of no elections." Now, as you probably know, that Barnett decision reversed an earlier Supreme Court decision, the Gobitis case, which had been decided only 3 years earlier. Both of them involved statutes that were passed around the time of World War II, which required public school students to salute the American flag. And the statutes were subject to challenge by Jehovah's Witness school children who had a religious belief that it was sacrilegious to salute the flag, which for them was a graven image. In the Gobitis case, the Supreme Court rejected that constitutional challenge, and what we saw all over the country was Jehovah's Witness school children and other Jehovah's Witnesses being subject to terrible persecution. They were tarred and feathered, they were forced to swallow castor oil, and there was even a castration. Now, perhaps in response to this terrible public outcry, the Supreme Court realized the error of its ways, overturned itself 3 years later in the Barnett decision. What the Supreme Court is doing now is turning its back dramatically on that philosophy that it has to stem the majoritarian tide, which it announced in the Barnett decision. And I think the case that illustrates that best is a decision called Employment Division versus Smith, a case otherwise known as the Peyote case, a case from Oregon in 1990. In that case, basically, the Supreme Court said that the state of Oregon did not have to make an exception to its laws which criminalized the use of peyote for members of the Native American church who used it only to conduct a religious sacrament. There was no evidence that it was used outside the church or that it led to any adverse impact in terms of drug use in the larger society. The Supreme Court said, though, that there was no violation of the Free Exercise Clause unless the state of Oregon had deliberately and intentionally and maliciously set out to get the Native Americans. If they were merely the unintended sufferers of this general legislation, they had absolutely no recourse, the court said, under the Free Exercise Clause, thus overturning not only, in effect, Barnett, but a whole line of Supreme Court decisions about free exercise. I think, now, and let me say one other thing about it. What Justice Scalia said in his opinion in that case was, If the Native Americans want to get protection for their religious ritual, and this is a central ritual of that church, their only recourse is to go to the legislature and try to persuade the legislature to pass a statutory exemption. To his credit, Scalia was realistic, and he said, "We recognize that by virtue of being a minority religion, they're unlikely to have the political clout to persuade the legislature to pass that exception." But, he said, and I've got this language down pat because I find it so bone-chilling, he said, "But that is the unavoidable consequence of a democratic government. The unavoidable consequence is that a minority religious group's rights are held hostage to the political process." Don't you see that is a complete 180-degree turnaround from the stirring language in Barnett that says it is precisely the purpose of the Bill of Rights and the courts in enforcing the Bill of Rights to avoid those consequences. I think the most dramatic way of demonstrating the court's 180-degree repudiation is to note the fact that the majority opinion not only did not cite the Barnett case, it twice cited the Gobitis case, the one that Barnett had overturned, and violating all your Blue Book rules of citation in the citation, did not mention the fact that Gobitis had been overruled by Barnett. There, in my view, could not be a more dramatic way of showing that the court is literally but evasively rewriting constitutional law, constitutional history, and its role. Now, the Smith case illustrates a number of broader, very disturbing trends about what the Supreme Court is doing. One is judicial activism. You know, this is a court that is touted by the presidents who appointed most of the members as being judicial conservatives, being in favor of judicial restraint. Well, what are the principles of judicial restraint? They include you don't reach issues that are not squarely presented by the case in front of you. You being the court, you defer to the judgment of Congress, you defer to the expertise of executive branch agencies, and you show respect for judicial precedents. Well, I can't give you detailed examples, but let me tell you, there is a laundry list of cases where this court has violated every one of those maxims, not always selectively. There is selective adherence to these principles. They are whipped out conveniently when they can be used to support the substantive result that the court wants to reach. But I said Smith illustrates this rampant judicial activism, and I say that because this sweeping rewriting of not only free exercise law, but indeed of civil liberties law more generally, that the court accomplished in the Smith case was done with respect to an issue that not only did not have to be reached, it was never raised by the parties. And the case had been up to the Supreme Court twice. The issue that the court decided the case on had never been briefed or orally argued. And how's that for rampant judicial activism? Therefore, when this bombshell of a decision came out, immediately a petition for rehearing was joined in by an incredibly broad coalition. I'm sure when Mike McConnell is here, he will also be talking about how devastating this decision is. And Mike comes from a very different end of the political spectrum and the constitutional philosophy spectrum that I do. But virtually every constitutional law professor in the country signed this petition for rehearing, as did virtually every religious organization, as did cause organizations literally across the entire political spectrum. The New York Times commented in an article about this petition for rehearing that they had never seen so many strange bedfellows, organizations and individuals that had never agreed on anything. But we all agreed, if the Supreme Court is going to reach this devastating decision, it surely cannot do so without at least reading briefs, without at least hearing oral arguments. Nevertheless, the court dismissed the petition for rehearing. One other broader theme that Smith illustrates, I'll just confine myself to one other example, is the devastating impact of the so-called war on drugs on constitutional law. I believe that it is much more accurately termed the war on the Bill of Rights. A drug exception has been created to virtually every constitutional guarantee. And probably not surprised that the constitutional guarantees that have to do with the criminal justice system are casualties of this war on drugs. But it's no coincidence, in my view, absolutely no coincidence, that free exercise law is twisted out of recognition in a case that involved drugs. And I could give you examples literally across the entire spectrum of the Constitution. It was a major theme of the court's decisions in the last term. For example, I will confine myself to one example. In a case called Florida versus Bostick, the Supreme Court upheld what are euphemistically called bus sweep searches. Now, in this search, which was typical, police officers and drug enforcement officers go onto a bus which is stopped midway in its route. The driver gets off the bus, shuts the door behind him. The officers, who are wearing uniforms with badges, with guns visibly apparent, go down this narrow aisle of the bus to a person sitting in the back and ask him whether he will allow them to search his possessions. The Supreme Court held this was a consensual search. Now, I want you to know that among the organizations which argued fiercely that this was not a consensual search were not only what you would predict, the ACLU and criminal defenders organizations. Also on our side of this case was an organization called Citizens for Effective Law Enforcement. Citizens for Effective Law Enforcement. Yes, they are exactly what you would suspect from the name. In the long history of that organization, they had never entered a case other than to argue for expanding police power. Still, Citizens for Effective Law Enforcement said, this goes too far. Didn't go too far for the Supreme Court. Well, and I will say one other thing about all of these cases in the criminal justice system and in the war on drugs, because today is one day after the anniversary of the videotaped police beating of Rodney King in Los Angeles, March 3rd, 1991. And what a dramatic reminder that was, that citizens need protection against the police, especially if they are people of color. And yet the Supreme Court gives the police power even beyond what Citizens for Effective Law Enforcement say that they need. Well, where do we turn now that the federal courts and the Supreme Court have turned their backs on civil rights and civil liberties? As I'm fond of telling my constitutional law students, you may have heard it from your professors here as well, fortunately, the Supreme Court's interpretation of the federal Constitution is a floor for our rights. It is not a ceiling. The Supreme Court simply tells the other branches of government, this is the level below which you may not sink in terms of individual rights, minority group rights, but other government officials are free voluntarily to provide more rights than the Supreme Court says they have to. And this theme was something that was touched on, I think, very effectively. This was a full-page ad that the ACLU took out on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. You won't be able to read it, but you can see the format. It looks like an obituary. Roe v. Wade, 1973-1992, ? But, as the text says, this is not a death announcement, it is a birth announcement. The birth of a bold new initiative to guarantee the right of all women to decide for themselves whether to bear a child. And it then outlines the alternative strategies that we are turning to, not only in terms of reproductive rights, but in terms of the entire civil rights and civil liberties agenda. One, we turn to Congress. And in fact, a large measure of what we've, proportion of what we've been doing in Congress lately is trying to get Congress to undo the negative effects of Supreme Court decisions. The best example, the most successful example recently, is the Civil Rights Act of 1991, which had the effect of undoing a series of hostile Supreme Court decisions in 1989 and 1990. With respect to the Smith decision, that same, the Peo Brody case, that same broad coalition that asked the court to reexamine its position is now supporting something that's called RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And of course, in terms of reproductive freedom, we are supporting the Freedom of Choice Act, which as a matter of congressional legislation would give women the same rights that we have had under Roe v. Wade. The Reproductive Freedom Project of the ACLU has issued these postcards that are pre-printed with messages to members of Congress. The reprints a political cartoon which shows the Constitution of the United States after it's been tampered with by the Supreme Court. There's a sign on the Constitution that says "For men only." And the text is, "Don't allow the Supreme Court to have the last word. Support legislation that will protect the right to choose abortion. Women must never be forced to return to the back alleys for their medical care." In addition to federal legislation, we are turning with success in many states to state legislatures, again using abortion as an example. In the 2.5 years since the Supreme Court's Webster decision, 4 states have passed laws that give women protection, the same protection they have had under the Constitution. We can also use state constitutional litigation. In many states, the state constitutions are more protective of civil rights and civil liberties than is the U.S. Constitution. And finally, one strategy that we are seriously considering is that of constitutional amendment. Maybe this is the most effective way to guarantee reproductive freedom and perhaps other forms of personal privacy. One historic precedent for that approach, of course, is the Women's Suffrage Amendment. The suffragists believed, with a great deal of reason, as we do with respect to reproductive freedom, that the 14th Amendment already guaranteed them the rights they were seeking. After all, the 14th Amendment says that no state may deny any citizen the privileges and immunities of citizenship. And surely voting must be a privilege and immunity of citizens. Well, it was only after some of the suffragists were actually arrested and convicted for the crime of voting that they realized that much as they thought the Constitution already guaranteed this right, they would have to support an amendment that explicitly made that clear, and we may have to do the same thing with respect to reproductive freedom. There's one final strategy that one can pursue to counter the hostile efforts of the current Supreme Court. I can't take credit for this idea. I heard it from another law professor who was talking about free speech and what do we do to preserve that against the Supreme Court's onslaughts. He said it to an audience which was even less young than this one, so I think the statement is better taken here than it was in that audience. Basically, he said, "Outlive the bastards. Outlive the bastards." That's basically what they've done to us. And that may be a very good technique. You know, a very conservative constitutional scholar, Bruce Fine, thinks, who is very supportive of the results of the Supreme Court's decisions, is very distressed because he thinks that the reasoning is so shoddy that all it will take will be a new generation of justices with a different philosophy who will be able to absolutely rip to shreds these decisions because he thinks they're so poorly reasoned. Some of you may have seen the article in which Bruce Fine set out this view. It was in the American Bar Association Journal. He said the court should be called the Haruska Court. Now, he is referring, of course, to Senator Roman Haruska, who was a senator in the 70s. There's absolutely no reason why you should have heard of him, because his only claim to fame was making the statement with respect to a then nominee for the Supreme Court by then President Richard Nixon. The nominee was said to be of very mediocre caliber, and Senator Haruska said, "Even if he is mediocre, there are a lot of mediocre judges and people and lawyers. They are entitled to a little representation, aren't they?" Bruce Fine thinks, and I'm not going to quarrel with him, that with the possible exception of Scalia, we have a court that is living up to Senator Haruska's dreams. Well, this alternative approach that I'm talking about, as you can imagine, is far more time-consuming and far more expensive than the classic approach of taking a case to the federal courts, to the Supreme Court. We now have to operate in the legislative arenas on a state-by-state basis, and it's going to be a very long, hard haul. I still am positive, and I'm about to end. I like to end on a positive note. Quoting that great constitutional philosopher, Woody Allen, he once said to an audience, gee, I'd really like to end on a positive note, but I can't think of anything positive to say. Would you settle for two negatives? Well, I don't have to do that. I really do think that if we look back over the course of history, even at times when the Supreme Court has been hostile, we have been able to find other strategies for ultimately protecting civil rights and civil liberties. It is hard work. It is time-consuming work. For some of us, we'll work for the rest of our lives and see relatively little progress. But I do have that basic optimism, and I'm going to end by quoting somebody who I think had even more of a basis for feeling discouraged and yet did not. That was Justice Thurgood Marshall. Despondent. Haven't you given up hope about these causes that you have dedicated your life to? And Marshall said, nothing can shake my faith in my country. I still believe firmly that right will win out. And I say to you, if Thurgood Marshall did not feel discouraged after becoming virtually a lone champion of rights and liberties on the court, indeed, if he did not lose hope during the 30s and 40s and early 50s, when the cause of racial justice seemed even more remote than it does today, then how can we possibly give up hope now? Thank you very much. I assume we have time for questions. Excellent question. I shouldn't be grading questions, but I don't know if you could all hear it. The question was, O'Connor has carved out kind of a middle position, not only with respect to reproductive freedom, but indeed it's a typical O'Connor position, to articulate a stricter test than the majority would, one that on its face seems more protective of rights, and yet in with only one exception that I'm aware of, she then goes on to apply the test in a way that reaches the same result that the majority does. So certainly as O'Connor applies it, it is not a test that gives me much comfort. The one exception, though, where she did apply it to strike down a regulation was in an abortion case in 1990. It was a case involving a requirement that parents, both parents of minors, be notified before the minor could have an abortion, even if the parents had never lived together, even if they didn't know how to contact one of the parents, even if one of them had been abusive. And O'Connor said that is an undue burden. Until that time, it was a common joke, at least among law professors, that O'Connor had never met a regulation that she saw as imposing an undue burden. But I think we have a very sad predictor of how the undue burden test would be applied. if it indeed became the law, because that is what the test that the Third Circuit used in the case that is now before the Supreme Court. In Planned Parenthood versus Casey, that involved a Pennsylvania statute which imposed a series of very onerous restrictions on abortion, all of which had, with one exception, all of them had previously been struck down by the Supreme Court under the strict scrutiny test that it used pursuant to Roe. The Third Circuit, consistent with my interpretation of Webster, said, you know, Roe v. Wade has already been overturned. If we look at the analysis that was used by the majority of justices in Webster, in Rust, in the minor cases, we find that there is certainly not a majority that supports strict scrutiny anymore. Therefore, we are going to use the O'Connor's undue burden test. And using that test, the Third Circuit then proceeded to uphold all but one of these restrictions, all of which, as I said, had failed under a strict scrutiny approach. And indeed, there was a split decision. It was a panel of three. The dissenter wanted to go even further. The only provision that failed the undue burden analysis was a requirement of notification of husbands. And the lower court had found, and the appellate court by a 2-1 vote upheld it, that this would subject women to violence, to physical abuse, to mental abuse, and it would constitute an undue burden. But the third member of that court said, and that's the basis for Pennsylvania appealing to the Supreme Court, that is not an undue burden, and made, you know, it's a very nebulous test, and he certainly thought even spousal notification would survive. Yeah. They just heard oral arguments earlier this week.
I must say, as a citizen libertarian in the modern body, on one hand, it does look like putting me on the verge of awesome expansion of traditionally conceived personal right, making the right to property, and an interpretation of the statement was that, what should we say, radically expand that given to our rights as individuals. On the other hand, I agree with Professor Epstein on NPR, in the case they're saying, if we've got the NLRB, then you're going to raise oil from the Constitution, and we've got most of the provisions of the Civil Rights Act. So I'm curious about two things. One, just your sense of where the court's going to go on that. And secondly, how, as committed to libertarians, in some sense, of being consistent, do we deal with this case? We just pull another Second Amendment.
There are a lot of questions rolled up into that one, and in some ways you raise all of modern constitutional theory, much of which, I mean, really, let's get what we're talking about is Lochner and substantive due process and the turn that the court took in the famous Caroline Products case, which I was alluding to, in which it said, henceforth, we are going to apply essentially non-scrutiny to any regulation that impacts on property rights, and strict scrutiny to any that impact on so-called personal rights. And the consequence is that anything goes in the property rights regulation realm, and until recently, virtually nothing went in terms of regulating so-called personal liberties. I'm saying so-called because I think it is hard to make a principled distinction, and it's interesting, depending on your political ideology, you may have a different conception of what a property right is. Back in the 60s and 70s, those of a liberal or left orientation were arguing that there is a property right to receive certain government benefits, for example, and surely I know Richard Epstein would oppose that. I do think, but Gerald Gunther wrote a foreword to the Harvard Law Review in Supreme Court issue in 1975, 1973. He was here as a visiting professor, and it was it's a very famous article about equal protection in which he coined those phrases about strict scrutiny being strict in theory and fatal in fact. And he predicted back then, I've recently reread the article, that there was an inherent danger about this bifurcation of constitutional standards. He thought it created an inherent instability under which you might be setting up a situation which could topple. And he made a strategic argument aimed at litigators, saying maybe all rights would be more secure if you subjected all of them to some kind of intermediate scrutiny. And he has proven to be prophetic, because what I was alluding to in my talk is exactly what he suggested, that the court has collapsed the two standards, and that completely deferential analysis that it heretofore had used only with respect to property rights is now being applied to the classic personal rights. Indeed, in Webster, in Rehnquist's opinion for the plurality, he said, we need not decide now whether the right to choose an abortion is a fundamental right. And he didn't use the word right. He said it is certainly a liberty interest. Now, these are all constitutional terms of art. It is certainly a liberty interest. And what did he cite? He cited post-Lochner property cases, right to contract cases, and then proceeds to subject these regulations on the liberty interest to the what Blackmun accurately said was non-scrutiny. So, you know, we've lost in that sense, and I think strategically in the future, as well as for the principled reason that it's a fairly arbitrary distinction between a property right and a personal right. I think they are mutually reinforcing in terms of the framers of the Constitution. There's no doubt that rights of personal property were very dear to their hearts, and I think for those of us who focus on different kinds of rights as a matter of priority, one can argue that without certain security in property interests, it really is meaningless to say you have a right to free speech or you have a right to vote or a right to education and so forth. I also think that the takings argument is one that could potentially be used to support rights that are perhaps more familiar to the traditional civil libertarian agenda than the right to develop marshland in South Carolina, which is what's at issue in this case. A professor at Capital University in Columbus, Ohio, is now writing an article that argues, and she says that Epstein has given approving comments to it, in which she argues that a woman has a property right in her own body, and therefore any abortion regulation constitutes a taking of that property interest, as to which the government must compensate, and the compensation would clearly be unaffordable. So, you know, I think we should not think in those what I think are artificial categories. But it doesn't mean then that the ACLU has to have prime on its agenda defense of those rights. First of all, in terms of whether one could get a veto-proof majority, assuming no pro-choice president is elected in the foreseeable future, the vote, I think one indication of it is the vote on the legislation to overturn the gag rule decision, in which we were 12 votes short of an override in the House. And that's heartbreakingly far away, and yet in terms of the numbers that we're dealing with, fairly close. And those who are experts in the political arena, in a way that the ACLU is not, have said that, and I mean political in the sense of partisan politics, NARAL being the prime example in this field, have said that they believe in the foreseeable future, not the next round of elections, but the next few rounds of congressional elections, if the pro-choice forces carefully target a few key districts, they believe that that gap can be closed. In terms of the argument, the federalism argument, it's the second time I've been asked about it recently, and I'm baffled by it. I'd like to hear you make it, given how, I mean, because it seems to me that the well, until now, the interpretation of Congress's power, even under the Commerce Clause, let alone under the 14th Amendment, has been so broad that it would be hard to find an exception. Having said that, however, there is another case pending in the Supreme Court for my own state. The court just granted cert a few weeks ago, called New York versus United States, which is said to be a potential vehicle for overturning the Garcia decision. Then you would have to argue that, again, I think that even if that happened, it seems to me that would not apply to this situation. You would have to argue that it is such an inherent aspect of state sovereignty to regulate what women can do with their bodies. Well, maybe I'm just not a good devil's advocate, but I think that would be a weak argument. Now, the only other way that the Supreme Court could strike down the Freedom of Choice Act would be if they found that it violated constitutional rights of the fetus. But so far, there has not been a member of the Supreme Court who has taken that position. They have all said that this is a matter that can be regulated by the states, and the states may allow abortion. Now, that is obviously inconsistent with the view that the fetus is a constitutionally protected person. There was some concern based on his pre-nomination writings that Clarence Thomas might have the natural law philosophy that the fetus is a protected person. Even if he did, he would be a vote of one on that position. Well, I can't say what was in the mind of the cartoonist who wrote this, but let me, the cartoon that we've reprinted, but let me tell you how I interpret it. It was not saying that men are against reproductive freedom or all women are for it. We certainly know that's not true. But I think it's making a very important point about the abortion issue, which is not often made, and that is that this is an issue of women's rights. And I, of course, there are men who are great champions of women's rights, and Harry Blackmun is a good example of it. But I think it's very important to make this point. So much of the debate about abortion has been framed in terms of the constitutional privacy issue, or in terms of pro-life. And therefore, I think we have lost sight of the message that was the key to the early reproductive freedom advocates in this country, and that is that women cannot be full and equal citizens in this country, full and equal participants in our society, until we have control of our reproductive destinies. And in the last few Supreme Court cases on reproductive freedom, amicus briefs have been written, most recently by two women then on your faculty, Kathleen Sullivan and Susan Estrich, arguing that even if the court overturns Roe and its privacy rationale, there is an independently sufficient constitutional justification for striking down prohibitions and regulations on abortion, and that is that they violate norms of gender equality under the Equal Protection Clause.
From a civil liberty point of view, I wanted to know what your views on the Operation Rescue movement are, and if you did feel that it violated, that some arrests not all violated freedom of speech and freedom of peaceful assembly. with your organization?
We have. We already have. Operation Rescue has been our client in a number of states, including California and Connecticut, on precisely the issues that you mentioned. I think really very straightforward civil liberties principles are involved. They have a right to peacefully demonstrate, but that right stops at a point where they are physically interfering with and obstructing the exercise of other people's rights, namely the rights of access to clinics. But we have often been in the position with respect to Operation Rescue and other so-called pro-life organizations to argue that the injunctions that have been issued against their demonstrations are too restrictive, remove them too far from the site of the clinic, and therefore interfere with their effective protest. With respect to the arrest, I see we recently lost a case in California, but we'll appeal it, in which the police are using what they call pain compliance techniques. I mean, what an Orwellian term. It literally is, it doesn't do permanent damage, so I guess Clarence Thomas would have no constitutional problem with it. But as the name suggests, it does cause pain, which we argue is violates due process rights as well as others. And the other context in which we've represented Operation Rescue, I think I alluded to earlier, one of its founders is one of our clients in seeking access to the ballot, to the Democratic presidential ballot in Florida. We also have opposed a technique that other pro-choice organizations have used to counter Operation Rescue and other anti-choice demonstrators. These pro-choice advocates have invoked the RICO statute and sought punitive damages against Operation Rescue, seeking to put them out of business. From the beginning, when RICO was first proposed, the ACLU consistently has opposed it as violating all kinds of civil liberties, and so we refuse to invoke it against anti-choice demonstrators. Yeah, that is currently before the Supreme Court, and we agree that statute does give federal courts jurisdiction. Oh, I'm a person too, thank you. Well, of course, President Bush's record on civil liberties has been absolutely terrible. And we are not a partisan organization, so I hope you don't translate that into we oppose Republicans. There are many Republicans who are, the head of our Washington office is a Republican, who, the head of all of our legislative operations in the country, to give just one prime example. And elected Republican officials are stalwarts of the ACLU. But President Bush has, I read this recently, he has supported more constitutional amendments than any president. So, I mean, he's sort of being open about, it's no wonder he opposes the ACLU, because we're trying to defend the Constitution. He's openly trying to change the Constitution. So I don't see much, and I needn't mention David Duke, of course. I assume that he's not within the realm of possibility for you. On the other side, there, one thing that concerns me is that there has not been very much attention to explicit attention to the issues that I care about. I think they're not seen as being politically popular issues, especially since 1988, when Michael Dukakis really took a battering that I think it was unnecessary for him to take, by the way. It seems that none of the candidates is expressly, with one possible exception, how can I forget Senator McCarthy, I know at least one of his supporters is here in the audience. He has consistently been very supportive of individual rights and liberties. I don't know what that has to do with it. In terms of reproductive freedom, I understand that every Democratic candidate went to a NARAL fundraiser on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, and to that extent showed at least some support for reproductive rights.
At least according to Gore Newborn, the ACLU has taken the position that speech codes on campus are not a good thing and ought to be deemed to be unconstitutional and wrong. And it seems to run into conflict with another core notion of the ACLU, which is associational freedom and private institutions' ability to organize themselves as they would like and under the rules and regulations that they prefer. So I'm interested in your thoughts in terms of that complex tension on a private university, especially in a situation where there's a strong argument to be made that racist speech and homophobic speech tends to silence people and prevents people from exercising their ability to speak freely and participate.
It certainly is a very complex issue, and you've rolled several together, so let me try to separate them out. First, on the issue of hate speech codes in general, let's talk about public institutions. Let me make it clear, the ACLU has opposed only overly broad hate speech codes. We've got a very well-crafted policy that I'm very proud of that I think really does service to concerns of equality and free speech. And basically, our argument is consistent with what the law has always been, and it's why we've won the cases where we've challenged overly restrictive codes. The law recognizes that the mere fact that speech is used does not insulate it from punishment when what you were talking about is harassment, intimidation, threats, coercion, classically face-to-face targeted confrontations between an individual or small group. So let's, you know, dispel with, and I'm not associating with you, but some people think the ACLU is absolutely opposed to all codes. That's not correct. Now, the next level of issue that you pose is the more difficult one, and the one that's been more controversial, and that is, what about on private campuses? The ACLU has supported a piece of legislation in Congress called the Collegiate Speech Protection Act, sponsored by arch-conservative Republican Congressman Henry Hyde. Talk about strange bedfellows. And it's interesting, Hyde has been attacked by many conservatives who say, why are you a conservative supporting more government regulation? And the ACLU has also been attacked by liberals who say, why are you taking away the associational freedom and the academic freedom of these private institutions? The last draft I saw of Frank Michelman's piece, and I know it was still a draft, he said that he started writing it with the presumption that he would share this liberal unease with the Collegiate Speech Protection Act. But as he thought about it and as he wrote it, he couldn't come up with a persuasive argument. And I have thought about it very hard. I don't think that organizations, that academic institutions have a free speech right to stifle the speech of their students. And I should back up and say, all that this legislation does is give students on private campuses a private right of action for injunctive relief to enforce the same free speech guarantees that they would have if they were on a state university campus. And I don't understand, I'm with Frank, I can't think of what the constitutional, put aside the Constitution, what the civil liberties interest is on the part of a private university to say we don't want our students to express speech that go we have an interest or a civil liberties interest in suppressing speech of students beyond what the Constitution already allows. Now, I've debated this issue a lot with your faculty member, Randy Kennedy, and he makes an argument in terms of diversity. And my counter to that is, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom. Universities can define their own persona, and some universities may want to create an environment where civility is emphasized over free speech. That is precisely the same argument, along with the freedom of association argument, that was used to oppose the Civil Rights Act in 1964. Private universities and other private institutions said, we have a freedom of association right not to associate with them if we don't want to. And by the way, it's no coincidence that this legislation is simply an amendment to the Civil Rights Act, a statement that there are some rights that are so fundamental that even private institutions, which are not subject to direct constitutional prohibitions, those private institutions must respect those rights. I believe that racial equality is one of those rights, and I believe that free speech is one of those rights. Now, Randy Kennedy is consistent in his view. I asked him, you know, how can you say that private universities should be free to suppress the free speech of their students, but should not be free to engage in racial discrimination? And he said he thought that private universities should be free to engage in racial discrimination. So he is consistent, but I and the ACLU say that equality and free speech are both such fundamental rights that they must both be respected in the private sector. He's still trying. It's taking him a long time, and he's very smart, so. Yes.
How realistic do you think it is that state courts will become the new protectors of civil liberties? And along with that, do you foresee a nation where some citizens of certain states are going to have all kinds of rights and exemptions of other states?
It's already true. There are the movement to aggressively use state court interpretation of state constitutions in a more rights protective way is at least 20 years old. And as a result, Californians, to take a good example, Oregonians, to take another, definitely have more constitutional rights in many areas than do citizens of other states. Whether that is a movement that will survive, I'm not particularly optimistic about, California being a good example, where we, you will recall, I guess, what, about 5 or 6 years ago, there was a very targeted and effective campaign to remove from the Supreme Court the Chief Justice and two Associate Justices who were responsible for some of those rights-expanding decisions. Most state Supreme Court justices are not appointed for life. I heard today that in Massachusetts they are, so at least once somebody got on the court, he or she would not feel subject to political pressure. Even so, it does perhaps, it puts a lot of onus on the original appointing authority, who is a politically elected official. And I've been told by the executive director of the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts that your Supreme Judicial Court is undergoing a personnel change that reflects some political changes in this country. So the fact that most state Supreme Courts are, in fact, political bodies and not secured by the lifetime tenure that federal judges are, I think means that they're not necessarily a secure bastion unless you have a political climate in the state, unless either of two things, you have a political climate in the state that's supportive of rights and liberties, or you have a very apathetic public that just doesn't get involved in judicial elections. Thank you very much.